Let's look at chapter 32 of Job. Well, life is fragile, isn't it? When you get up in the morning, you don't know what's going to happen, do you? You don't know what kind of news you're going to get. When all of a sudden over the radio comes news that we have bombed Iraq. I remember when the Gulf War started in 91. I was out of the country. I was in Canada at the time. And it was weird being out of the country when our country attacked or was leading in an attack. And to hear the comments on the international scene. We live sort of in a bubble, don't we? We kind of cruise along thinking every day is pretty much going to be like the last one. Planning ahead, and it's not wrong to plan, and it's not wrong to basically treat life as though it's going to go on with some sense of order and direction. I mean, you got to be crazy not to treat life that way. You have to treat it as if it's got some semblance of normalcy to it. But you also have to realize it's very fragile, and it can change any time. The lives that we live, that we think are so stable at times, and that we sort of count on, can be stopped in a moment. It's as dangerous driving down Highway 62 as it is being on an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. And I have to remind myself of that as my son-in-law's over there and on one of those aircraft carriers. And I think to myself, oh, Lord, keep him safe. And then I get in my car and don't think a thing about it and drive all the way to Medford. It's I'm risking my life out there in the fog and on the ice and with all of you guys, you know. You're risking your life out there with me. That's the way it really is. Life is fragile. And the fragility of it when it falls apart crashes in on us. And that's why the book of Job has so much to say. Job's life, he thought, was pretty straightforward. He was a godly man. He had everything going for him, far more wealthy than anybody I know personally. He was a man who could be considered among the greatest, if not the greatest man in his entire country. A man renowned for wisdom, godliness, wealth, power, prestige, family life. There wasn't an area, not one area of his life that wasn't apparently very, very blessed by God, and yet he lost it all in a day. Lost it all. I mean, you talk about fragile. I mean, his entire life utterly caved in. Now, we know from reading the beginning and the ending of Job that this was something God was doing or allowing to happen for another reason that Job did not understand, but still, it reminds us of just how fragile life here on earth really is and how we need to realize that. You say, well, man, it just bothers me if I think about how fragile life is. Well, it does bother us, but that bothersomeness of it makes us think about eternity, makes us think about things that we wouldn't think about when we're simply intoxicated with the successes and the happiness of what's going on in our lives. And so you say, well, it's difficult to think about these things. Yes, it is. But it breeds a sense of wisdom and perspective that actually makes the enjoyment of life even better because it's not shallow. So there are reasons for these things. When Job lost everything in his life, it caused a crisis for his friends. Now you say, well, Job had a crisis. Yes, Job had a crisis. It was a major crisis of his faith. It was also a crisis for his buddies, theologically, because they came, and his first three friends came and said to him, you know, you've sinned secretly. That's why this has happened. We can't think of any other reason why it's happened, so we're going to explain you away, Job. And, of course, that wasn't true. We know it wasn't true, and Job insists that it wasn't true so vehemently that he gets downright angry. He shakes his fist at God, and he accuses God of being unjust. Really, when it boils right down to it, as this thing keeps going and going and going, he actually accuses God of being unjust. And we would stand back before we rebuke him too heavily because it's a pretty heavy thing he was going through. And people say things like that. But he did. He said some stuff that really hurt. He said some stuff that if you can hurt God's feelings, if such a thing is possible, well, Job did. And he certainly hurt the feelings of the guys who came and hurt his feelings. They were all hurting each other's feelings. It was a hurt feeling fest, actually, for several chapters, because they were accusing him of stuff he didn't do, and then he would fire back at them, you know. You've read all the way through it. It's interesting that nobody thought all the way through this up to chapter 32. Well, as a matter of fact, even after this, it doesn't occur to these guys. But it's interesting that nobody thought to themselves, maybe this is just a trial, and placing the blame is not as important as simply helping each other get through it. I'm amazed that nobody thought of that. Why is it that we have to feel like we got to explain everything, and that once we've placed the blame, we've done our job, and that that's all there is to it, and we go back to whatever else we were doing before that? Is that really what we're here for, just to place the blame, explain away the problem? Or are we here to help each other through the problems? Even if your friend shot himself in the foot like they accused Job of doing, which he didn't, but maybe your friend has, you know? Maybe you've got a friend that really shot themselves in the foot, and they're really, you know, they're in it. And you can point to them and say, well, you know, you did this to yourself. True? Is that all there is to it? Is that all we're supposed to do is say, well, it's your own fault? Very good. Thank you very much. Next. Short counseling appointment. Very short. Oh, this is your fault. Okay, bye. Or is there a way of dealing with it in which we say to ourselves, you know, for better or for worse, this is a trial that we need to endure together. Maybe we can help each other with it. Maybe we can encourage one another through the thing. It's interesting that when that happens, there's a bonding and a health and a strength that occurs in people's lives that would not have occurred if the crisis had never occurred. And there oftentimes are healings and wisdom that comes to us at those moments that we've been praying for all along. And then the Lord allows this horrible thing to happen, and we lose track of the fact that we prayed for all that wisdom. And then somehow in the process, we help each other through it, and somehow after it, we go, wow, Lord, you know, you really answered a lot of major prayers by allowing this horrible thing to take place. Well, they never thought of that. And Job was caught up with his boils, which they are very absorbing. You know, boils can really get your attention, especially when they cover your whole body. And he was also caught up with the loss of everything. And his friends were caught up in their anger. And he gets to the end of chapter 31 the end of his speeches is the end of chapter 31, and he basically says, I've been right all along. God was wrong to let this happen to me. We had a deal, which was a misunderstanding on Job's part. We had a deal. If I kept the rules, everything would be fine. Everything's not fine, and I can't figure it out, and I think God is cheating me, and I'm going to stand on my integrity. He's partly right and partly wrong. I mentioned this last week, and I want to review it a little bit. He was right in a couple of ways. He refused to use his calamity as an excuse for further sin, which is often what humans do. When calamity strikes, if they've been trying to walk with the Lord, some bad thing happens to them, they go, well, that's that. I guess, you know, I deserve a break today. It's the you deserve a break today approach to sin. And use it as an excuse. You know, I've had a hard day. I deserve to sin a little. Like, that really makes sense. But people do that. But Job didn't do that. And that was the right thing. That was a good thing for him. He did not sin, at least not in the crass ways. And we'll see that he is accused of something by both God and by the new guy we're going to meet tonight. But he refused to use his calamity as an excuse for crass disobedience to the Lord, as often people do today. And secondly, he refused to curse the Lord. Now, by curse the Lord, I mean to apostatize. That means to say, I regret ever having served God. I hereby repudiate my faith, and I will curse God to his face. Now, see, he didn't do that. In fact, his anger at God was basically because he wanted God to come and talk to him. It wasn't because he didn't believe in God. It's because he did believe in him, and it drove him to the brink of accusing God of injustice. But he never cursed him, and he never apostatized. He never turned his back on his faith. He was angry, and he gets rebuked for his anger because there's some real mistakes in what he did and what he said. But he never cursed the Lord like Satan said he would. Satan said, if I do these things, God, your buddy Job will curse you to your face. And God said, no, he won't. And you can do certain things to him, and he allowed this to happen. And Job really did hang in there. He did not curse God to his face. He also did a couple things wrong. One we've talked about briefly. He misunderstood the covenant that he had with the Lord. He really thought that if he basically did everything he was supposed to do, everything would be fine. By fine, I mean his life would have all the physical pleasures and health and strength that you can expect out of life or ever desire out of life. And of course, that's not part of the deal. God very often, in fact, usually, blesses our lives marvelously over long periods. But he doesn't have to. And we're not in a deal where we say, well, look, I've done my part. Now God's got to do his. And if he doesn't, he's unjust in not doing that. That was a misunderstanding on Job's part, as well as his friends. They all misunderstood that. And another wrong thing was that he allowed his pain to make him think that the Lord had truly been unfair. Now, this is where what we'll see tonight actually comes into play. And in the weeks to come after Christmas, we'll get back into Job a little bit. But it is this part of it where, in Job's mind, the pain was so horrible that he allowed that to actually impugn, in his own thinking, to impugn God. Not just in his words, but in his thinking. He really began to think, maybe God is unjust. How can such a thing be? And yet, I don't see, he couldn't figure out how these bad things could be happening to him, since he thought, it was his opinion, he was such a nice guy. Which he was on the outside, he was a nice guy. He allowed the pain to actually impugn the goodness and the sovereignty of God. And this led him down a particular logical road, which ended in a real rebuke. Not disaster for him, but it ended in a real rebuke for him. Remember a couple of things. Suffering does not bestow virtue on a person. Just because a person suffers does not mean that they are not a sinner saved by grace. It does not mean that they have no other problems. Some people's suffering is so horrible that we think to ourselves they must have been completely purified by this suffering and they must have actual positive virtue put to their account simply by virtue of the fact that they suffered so much. They must be truly righteous people. They've suffered so much unjustly. But it doesn't work that way. Just because you've suffered does not mean you're right in all the things that are going on in your life. And you can't use that as a point of argument. If you blow it, you blow it. I don't care how much you've suffered. You may have suffered a lot. But if you blow it, you blow it. You don't get extra karma points so that you can sin some more just by virtue of the fact that you may have suffered what you think is unjustly. And we learn this from Job. Suffering doesn't bestow virtue on a person. And secondly, integrity doesn't incur debt on God's part. Remember that from last week? Integrity does not incur debt. It, just because we do what we're supposed to do anyway, does not incur debt on God's part. He doesn't owe us anything for that. As if he's saying, man, I've been looking around for so long for anybody who would do what I say. I'm so glad I found somebody that will at least do it part-time. That I'm just so happy that I've got one friend. Man, I thought I was without friends, and I'm sort of begging, for friends, and so I'm so glad. As if it incurred some sort of debt. That's not it. Integrity should have been there all along. And Job really didn't understand some of these things. And you can tell by his argumentation. You can tell by what he says about God. By the time he gets to the end of this, it really boils him down to the nubbies, and what really comes out is that he believes God owes him something, at least an explanation. And the fact of the matter is that that's not so. God didn't owe him anything. Job owed it to God to obey him all the way along in the first place. God's gracious gifts to Job were simply that, gracious gifts, not payment, not a bargain, just gifts. That's all it was. That's all it ever had been all along. But you can tell by how Job feels and his anger toward God and what he says to God and what he says about God, you can tell that somehow through the years of blessing that occurred in his life, a subtle thing occurred in which he began to think that God was blessing him because he was so good. And that's not true. Job was a good guy, especially by the standards of his day. But that wasn't why God was blessing him. God was blessing him because God blesses, because he's gracious and kind and good and loving. Job misunderstood these things. Now that brings us to chapter 32. And in chapter 32, we meet a new guy. Chapter 32 through chapter 37, the Elihu discourses. Elihu is a new guy. The other three have kind of petered out. They've sort of ran out of stuff to say to Job. And Elihu's been watching, which makes me wonder if maybe there were other people watching as well. This was a famous man who'd been through this horrible experience. Maybe there was a whole group of folks standing around listening to the debates. And maybe that's why we have such good, accurate record of what was going on, what was being said, because someone was actually taking notes. There was official debate here between these men that was being observed by who knows how many people. But we know at least Elihu was there, and he's a young guy who's been standing around for however long listening to these debates that probably took place over a long period of time. You know, people resting in between. It takes a long time. I mean, it takes a lot of energy to sustain a good fight. And so they had to sleep at night, you know, and refresh themselves and come back and duke it out again in the morning. And so over a period of time, Elihu's watching and listening and watching and listening. Finally, they all run out of stuff to say. Job finishes his speech and says, "That's it. That's all I've got to say." And his bottom line was, "God's been unfair to me." That's what it all came down to. And Elihu says, "Well, that's not all I've got to say." And his discourses are interesting. Now, people are divided as to whether Elihu has really got anything new to add. And if you read commentaries and you read stuff about the Bible, you'll find that different people have different opinions of Elihu. He's a unique guy. He's not like the other three. And he doesn't show up. We don't know he's there until all of a sudden he pipes up and says something. And it's so unique that in terms of his appearance on the scene, that some people think he doesn't even belong there at all. And so they debate about these kinds of things. But actually, you'll find that Elihu's words make a very good transition into the words of God, which are the very next thing that happens. After the Elihu speeches, after his discourse, God actually says, "Job, I got some words to share with you." And interestingly, if you read Elihu's words first, they actually make a nice transition straight into what the Lord said. And Elihu says, "I'm speaking for God." So we'll see what this young man has to say. Let's begin in verse 1 of chapter 32. The three men ceased answering Job. These are the his other friends. They ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. They could not convince him of secret sin. But the anger of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzzite. Don't you love that? Who are you? I'm a Buzzite. Of the family of Ram, his anger burned against Job, because he justified himself instead of justifying God. And that's what that means. It means that Job felt he was more righteous than God. And that's actually when you get little threads of this from the very beginning, but it doesn't come to a full view until this last speech of Job's in chapter 32. And then it's obvious Job is more interested in exonerating himself than he is in actually trusting that God knows what he's doing. And that's what ticks Elihu off. It also ticks Elihu off that the other three guys cannot get off the deal about the secret past sin. They never convinced Job of it, and they're like a broken record. They keep coming back to it over and over. This bothers Elihu a lot. Elihu, by the way, was probably a nephew of Abraham. They all lived during the patriarchal period, about 2000 BC. And those guys lived a long time back in those days. And your nephew could actually be your own age, depending on how the family, they all had some really large, big families and so on. And you could have nephews and aunts and uncles that were all essentially of the similar generation. And Abraham had a brother named Nahor. Nahor had a son named Buzz. I don't know if it had anything to do with his haircut or his personality, or we don't know. But Elihu is a Buzzite. And so he's a relative of Abraham's. But basically he was mad at Job because Job was basically saying that he was more righteous than God, the end of verse 2. And his anger burned against the three friends as well, because they'd found no answer and yet had condemned Job. In other words, they couldn't prove that Job had done anything wrong, but they were just writing him off. In other words, the whole situation bothered Elihu. He just listened to it all, and he thought, "This is just not making sense. You guys are tearing each other to shreds, and I'm hearing a lot of mistakes on both sides." Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were years older than he was, the younger guy there. And Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of the three men, and his anger burned. So Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzzite, spoke out, and he said, "I am young in years, and you are old. Therefore, I was shy, and I was afraid to tell you what I think. I thought age should speak, and increased years should teach wisdom, but It is the spirit in a man, the breath of the Almighty, that gives understanding. And you want to underline a good verse. It's a good one. It is the spirit of God that brings wisdom, not just the years, you know, or the gray hair. The abundant in years may not be wise, nor may elders understand justice. So I say, listen to me. I'm going to tell you what I think. And everybody, you know, have you ever been in a conversation where everybody just kind of runs out, and then all of a sudden there's fresh horses, you know? Some guy says, I got something to say, and all of a sudden he's got all their attention, whereas he would not have if he'd have been there in the very beginning and started talking. But now, because he waits and waits and waits and waits, he kind of has the last word. By the way, that's not a bad piece of advice, especially if you are a younger person than everybody else who's going on and on and on about everything. It's not a bad piece of advice to just wait your turn, because eventually people will listen. They all get exhausted. They've said everything they have to say. And if you have something important to say, if it's that important, it can wait. And that's true. That's really true. So anyway, he says, do this. Abundance in years, the abundant in years may not be wise. It's possible. It's unusual. Usually age brings a certain amount of wisdom, but not always. Verse 11, I waited for your words. I listened to your reasonings while you pondered what to say. And I even paid close attention to you. Indeed, there was no one who refuted Job. I was listening to you guys. Nobody really had a case against Job. Not one of you answered his words. You weren't dealing with what he was asking, and your accusations were bouncing off. You're just name-calling, basically, and it's true. Verse 13, don't tell me you found wisdom. And God will rout him, not man, for he has not arranged his words against me, nor will I reply to him with your arguments. Now, I'm not going to use your line of reasoning, you guys. So he says, a pox on all of your houses. I'm tired of you, Job, and I'm tired of you guys. And I have something to say. They are dismayed. They answer no more. Words have failed them. And shall I wait because they don't speak, because they stop and answer no more? I too will answer my share, and I'll tell my opinion. I am full of words, and the spirit within me constrains me. I just can't keep my mouth shut. I've got something to say. Behold, my belly is like unvented wine. Now that's a picture for you. Like new wineskins, it's about to burst. it's picturesque, but what he means is he's swelling up with something to say, and he just can't hold it back anymore. So he kind of erupts here. And he says, I won't, verse 21, I'm not going to be partial to anybody, and I'm not going to flatter anybody, which we would have already probably gotten the impression that he felt that way even before he said it. I don't know how to flatter anybody, or my maker would soon take me away. Now, Job, please hear my speech and listen to my words. Behold, now I'm going to open my mouth. My tongue in my mouth speaks. My words are from the uprightness of my heart, and my lips speak knowledge sincerely. People say, well, this is a little pompous. You know, people who criticize Elihu. And maybe there's a case for that, but you have to understand. I don't, personally, my view of Elihu, and I'm among those who view Elihu as a guy who really does have some good things to say. And may very well be speaking for the Lord in this situation. I think his words correspond very well with what God actually says later in the next few chapters. But people read this, they say, well, maybe Elihu was just a pompous little pipsqueak who just couldn't keep his mouth shut, and maybe should have all along, because he says stuff like this, listen to me, I have wisdom to share with you, and so on. But you have to understand, too, that it was somewhat the style of the day to be a little wordy, especially when it's written down in poetry. And I don't think you should jump to the conclusion that he is pompous necessarily based on these things. He's approaching them in the style of the day, because he's about ready to say some kind of important stuff. He says, the Spirit of God has made me. The breath of the Almighty gives me life. Refute me if you can. Array yourselves before me. Take your stand. In other words, you can argue with me if you want to, if you've got any energy left. Behold, I belong to God like you. I too have been formed out of the clay. He's not claiming to be an angel. He's not claiming to be anything but a human being, but he has some wisdom to share that he feels is from the Lord. He says, behold, no fear of me should terrify you, nor should my pressure weigh heavily on you. I'm kind of a lightweight, you guys, but if you can stop what I'm saying, if you can argue against it, feel free. You've spoken in my hearing, he says to Job, and I've heard the sound of your words. You've said this, I am pure, without transgression. I am innocent. There is no guilt in me. And that's true. Job had said all that stuff over and over. Behold, God invents pretexts against me, says Job. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks and he watches all my paths as if to trap me. You know, behold, let me tell you, says Elihu. He says to Job, let me tell you, you are not right in this. God is greater than man. Now, that's true. Verse 12, that's a good piece of wisdom. You know, Job, just because you've suffered a lot, and interestingly, Elihu never makes light of Job's suffering, never calls him a jerk like his other friends did, never says he deserved it or anything. What Elihu does, interestingly, is he focuses on Job's current attitude, not his previous secret sins, but on his current attitude based on how he's responding to the pain. That's what Elihu does. And he says, Job, you're mistaken. You're just mistaken about this. You think that God, you're implying that God really is unjust. Job, do you really mean to imply that? Let me tell you, you are not right in this. This is a mistake. God really is greater than man. Interestingly, Elihu was saying this to Job, who had talked a lot about the greatness of God, and so had his friends. But you know, it's one thing to talk about the greatness of God, and it's a completely different thing to have deep in your soul the powerful reality of how great God really is. How awesome and brilliant he really is, and how wise he really is. It's one thing to be able to rattle off all the Latin theological terms that have to do with theology. It's another thing to be just impressed with the Lord. And Elihu is a man who's impressed with God far more than man, which is why he was a little upset that Job insisted on impugning God's character rather than impugning his own. And Elihu is correct. He says, why do you complain against the Lord that he does not give an accounting of all his doings? That is a classic verse. That is a classic verse. Circle that verse or underline it or write it on the mirror or something. It's a great verse. Why do you complain against him that he does not give an account of all his doings? What makes you think, Job, that God needs to answer to you? I'm not accusing you of the stuff these guys accused you of. I'm not saying you sin secretly. All I'm saying is you're mistaken to expect that the God of the universe owes you an explanation for anything. He owes you nothing. See, that's what he's getting at. He loves you. He cares for you. But he owes you zip, Job. Good point. It's a great point from this young guy. Indeed, God speaks once or twice, yet no one takes note of it. In a dream, in a vision, in the night, sound sleep falls upon men while they slumber in their beds, and he opens the ears of men. He seals their instruction that he may turn man aside from his conduct and keep him from pride. And he keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from passing over into Sheol. God actually keeps people alive. You say, no, he doesn't. He lets people die. No, he doesn't. He keeps people alive. We're thinking of it all backwards. It's all completely backwards. See, all sinners should have died a long time ago. They should have never been born, actually. And when we say, well, how could God let so-and-so die? The question really is more along the lines of, how could God let all of us live? How could God let anybody live, really, in light of who we are compared to who he is? We look at the whole thing completely backwards. And Elihu says, wait a minute. God actually allows people to live. And he does speak. Don't tell me that God never speaks. He does speak. Not always in the way we want, not always at the time we want, but he has spoken. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. God in previous times has spoken through his apostles and his prophets. To this day, he continues to speak. If I had a show of hands, I bet everybody in this place would raise their hand and say, I know for sure God has spoken to me. Not audibly necessarily, but there are times in my life when I was absolutely certain. Not every day, doesn't meet with me and confer about the events of the day that are coming up. But I know that he has guided me. When I look at it from his perspective, it happens regularly. And so that's what Elihu reminds Job of. Don't tell me this business that God is so unfair and he never speaks to you. Yeah, he's been quiet for a few months and you're going through a trial. But that doesn't mean that God has never done anything right. Man is chastened with pain on his bed. Verses 19 and following, he talks about how God speaks through pain and how he restores people. Actually, pain has a beneficial effect, and we've talked about it. It really does make people come to the Lord. most people have come to the Lord. In a sinful world, that's how most people do come to the Lord, is because of a crisis. And they give up on themselves, realize that, wow, life is really fragile. I thought it was unbreakable. I found out it's super fragile. I'm super fragile. Lord, help me. Okay. Glad you saw it. He uses pain that way, says Elihu. Verse 29. God does all these, oftentimes with men, to bring back the human soul from the pit, that he may be enlightened with the light of life. Pay attention, Job. Listen to me. Keep silent. Let me speak. If you have anything to say, then answer me. Speak, for I desire to justify you. I'm trying to help you out here, Job. If not, then listen to me. Keep silent, and I will teach you wisdom. Pretty gutsy thing for a young guy to say. Maybe a little conceit here, or maybe just style. Maybe that's just the style of the stuff. Chapter 34, he begins to talk, actually, and goes all the way through chapter 37 about how the Lord is, about who he is. Listen, just read a few of these. I won't go through all of them, but notice the emphasis in Elihu's speeches on the glory of God. Hear my words, you wise men. Listen to me, you who know. For the ear tests words as the palate tastes food. By the way, is that true? Does your ear test words like your tongue tastes food? Do you ever eat cottage cheese that was a little too old? All right, now we're on the same page. I've got your attention. What do? You spit it out. Actually, you don't even put it in your mouth as if it's got gray stuff on it. This is what I always watch for. You know, you pop it open there, and it's in the back of the fridge. It's kind of a bad scene. And if the gray stuff's coming out from under the top, you don't even need to open it. If you do open it and you smell it, you don't taste it. Or if you taste it and it hasn't kind of like started to turn colors yet, it's got that little, you see your tongue tastes it and it goes, blech, and you spit it out. Now here's the question. Do we do that with words? Do we do that with the stuff we listen to and watch and read? Do we taste what's being said and test it and spit it out if it's no good, like we would if it were food that was bad? It's a great picture. It's a great picture. And you'll probably be, you know, walking around from now on going, blech, 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 and listen to the radio and watch TV and, you know, go to a movie and halfway through, blech, blech. You don't really have to do that, but, you know, it's a thought. Okay, let's choose for ourselves, verse 4. Let's choose for ourselves what's right and know among ourselves what is good. Let's exercise a little wisdom here. Job has said that I am righteous, but God has taken away my right, my justice. Now, he's quoting Job specifically right here out of chapter 13 and chapter 27, where Job actually said these words, should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. Job says these things. What man is like Job who drinks up derision like water, who goes in company with workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men? This is the kind of stuff that evil people say. Job has said these things. For he said, it profits a man nothing when he is pleased with God or when he seeks to please God. Job has implied, in his anger, he has implied that it really isn't worth serving God because his life went into the garbage heap for a while. He's implied that this is true. Is that really true? Listen to me, says in verse 10. You men of understanding, far be it from God to do wickedness, from the Almighty to do wrong. Let's get our theology straight. He pays a man according to his work, and he makes him find it according to his way. God will not act wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice. God really is just. Stop implying, Job, that he is not just. Who gave him authority over the earth? In other words, who did God have to go to get permission to rule the earth? Nobody. He created it. So he didn't have to go. That's what he's saying. He didn't have to go to anybody for permission to take care of the earth. He has a right to it down through verse 15. That's what he's saying. And all flesh would perish together. A man would return to the dust. What if God, verses 13 to 15, basically saying, what if God simply said, that's it, end of game, end of play, all of you give me your spirits back. That would be it. And he has every right to do it. What a heavy thing. He has every right to do that. Every right in the world to just simply say, that's it. That's it. I'm done. Everybody, back home. All the spirits of all the people, back to the judgment seat. Just like that. Why doesn't he do that? Well, he will. Why hasn't he done it yet? He's saving people. He's saving people so that they don't go to hell when they come to the judgment seat. That's what he's doing. But he has every right, says Elihu, to call every human spirit home. What a heavy thing. Man would return to the dust. Verse 15. If you have understanding, hear this. He said, listen to the sound of my words. Shall one who hates justice rule? In other words, is injustice really going to rule in the universe? No. His eyes, verse 21, are upon the ways of man. And he does see all of his steps. And there's no darkness or deep shadow. And the workers of iniquity hide themselves. God sees it all. He goes down all the way through verse 30 with that. Verse 31. Has anyone said to God, I have borne chastisement. I will not offend anymore. Teach me what I do not see. If I have done iniquity, I will do it no more. Shall I recompense on your terms because you have rejected it? For you must choose and not I. Therefore declare what you know. Men of understanding will say to me and a wise man who hears me, Job speaks without knowledge and his words are without wisdom. Job ought to be tried to the limit because he answers like a wicked man. He adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Now Elihu does accuse Job of actually turning against God. But he does not accuse Job. If you've read all the way through the book of Job, he doesn't accuse Job of all the crass, horrible, secret, supposedly secret sins his friends did. What he does say is, Job, you are speaking in a way that is not commensurate with a man of faith. You really are impugning the justice of God, Job, and it's completely wrong of you to do that. In chapter 35, he continues to rebuke him. Do you think this is according to justice? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? Verse 2. What advantage will it be for you? What profit shall I have more than if I had not sinned? I will answer you and your friends with you. I'll tell all of you. Look at the heavens and see. Behold the clouds. They're higher than you. If you had sinned, what do you accomplish against God? If your transgressions are many, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give him? Or what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness is for a man like yourself, and your righteousness is for a son of man. In other words, Job, everything you do, God can protect himself from. You can't really hurt him unless he allows you to hurt him, which is one of the awesome realities about the Lord, because he does say that his people have hurt him in the things that they've done. And that means that he actually volunteers for the hurt. He doesn't have to allow it, but he does sometimes allow it. So when Job says, it's not worth it whether I sin or whether I do righteousness, Elihu reminds Job of how much greater God is than anything Job can do. Now again, over and over again, Elihu focuses on the glory of God. And he focuses on Job's kind of rank attitude in the midst of all of his difficulty. And he continues that down through verse 16. Verse 16 says, so Job opens his mouth emptily and he multiplies words without knowledge. This is almost directly what God says to Job in just a couple of chapters. And it's one of the reasons why I think Elihu's speech, his discourse, actually leads to what God is going to say. Chapter 36. The main burden of chapter 36 and chapter 37 is that God is sovereign, but he is also good. And sometimes the only thing you can fall back on is what you know to be true about the Lord, because you don't actually see goodness occurring. You have to fall back on what you already know about him when you don't understand what's going on. And that's what Elihu does. He draws all of them back to the goodness of God. And we'll see how this contrasts when we finish up this evening, but it contrasts a little with what the other men had done. It's similar, but it's not the same. Elihu continued, chapter 36. Elihu continued, and he said, wait for me a little, and I'm going to show you something. That there is yet more to be said on God's behalf. I will fetch my knowledge from afar, and I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker, for truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you. Now you read that, you go, one who is perfect in knowledge is with you. This little guy is a little bit arrogant, but he's not talking about himself. Turn over to chapter 37, verse 16. Don't you know about the layers of the thick clouds, the wonders of one perfect in knowledge? You see that? He's referring in that passage to the Lord. What he's saying back here in chapter 36 is that God really is still with you. One who is perfect in knowledge really is with you. The problem is you can't see what he's doing and you can't see what he's saying and he's not answering your questions. So now you're thinking he's either not there or he's not just. And Elihu reminds him, don't think that way. God really still is there. Behold, God is mighty. Verse 5, again, back in 36 here. God is mighty, but does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not keep the wicked alive. He gives justice to the afflicted. In other words, he is just. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but with kings on the throne, he has seated them forever, and they are exalted, and so on. He basically says, don't accuse God of injustice, Job. It's ridiculous to do that. Down through verse 16. But you were full, verse 17, you were full of judgment on the wicked. Judgment and justice take hold of you. Beware lest wrath entice you to scoffing. And do not let the greatness of the ransom turn you aside. In other words, don't let anything dissuade you from doing what is right, Job. Because you know that some of the things you've accused God of are not true. Will your riches keep you from distress or all the forces of your strength? Do not long for the night when people vanish in their place. Be careful. Do not turn to evil. You have preferred this to affliction. Behold, God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? Who has appointed him his way? In other words, who's telling God what to do? Nobody. God already knows. And who has said, you have done wrong? Well, actually, Job kind of said that. Matter of fact, Job actually did say that. You've done wrong. You've deprived me of justice. And Elihu reminds him, Job, wait a minute. Are we talking about the same God here? But notice, Elihu's approach to Job is not insulting like the other guy's was. He's correct, and he's saying a similar thing, but it's a different approach. And he continues that down through the end of chapter 36. In chapter 37, he says, at this also my heart trembles and leaps from its place. This is a man, Elihu is a man, who is absolutely impressed with God. Listen closely to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that goes out from his mouth. Under the whole heaven, he lets it loose, his lightning to the ends of the earth. After it, a voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice. He does not restrain the lightning when his voice is heard. God thunders with his voice wondrously, doing great things which we cannot comprehend. To the snow, he says, fall on the earth. To the downpour and the rain, be strong. You say, oh, no, 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 that's not the way it happens. Actually, see, water evaporates, and it goes and becomes clouds. And then when it runs into the mountains and it gets kind of cool, then it snows. See, we know how that works. Really. We've described how it works. We don't know what started it. We still don't know what started it. We think it was a giant accident. It's amazing. Just because we've described how it works does not mean we know how. This is an old story about a bunch of mice who lived in a piano. Have you ever heard that story? They all lived in the piano and they heard this marvelous music all the time. And for generations, the mice always believed that there was a great person playing the music. But then some mice got real smart one time and they decided to climb up from where they lived. And they climbed up and they discovered the strings within the piano that actually created the sound. And the little hammers, bing, 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 that would hit the strings. And they thought, well, there's the mystery. This is what makes the music. So they went down, they told all their little mice friends, really, it's just strings that are being hit by little hammers. That's what's doing this. And the music played on. And basically, that's what humanity keeps doing. We keep discovering the strings, more and more hammers, about what makes it all work. But the musician is still out there because the music keeps playing. Some mind has to be behind it. Anyway, he talks about that. He talks about how great God is down through verse 13. Listen, Job, verse 14. Listen to this, O Job. Stand and consider the wonders of God. Now, that is something you did not hear the other men talking about. The other men had a lot of theological power behind them, and they were really upset with Job because he was impugning God and so on. But Elihu's approach is different. Job, consider the wonders of God. Do you know how God establishes them, makes the lightning and the cloud to shine? Do you know about the layers of the thick clouds and the wonders of one who is perfect in knowledge? Interesting. He focuses so much on the glory and the sovereignty and the majesty of God. Very different than the other men who almost did that, but what they really focused on was the justice that they thought God would always bring about so that they could see it. Do you see the subtle difference between those two approaches? Well, we end chapter 37, and Elihu finishes his speech, and he challenges the other guys to answer him, and they don't, which is interesting. And if you think about it, they really can't. I mean, his words are pretty piercing. He doesn't accuse Job of anything that Job can really deny, because he quotes him. You see, what he's done is he said, Job, your attitude reeks. Just look at these quotes from you. Something's wrong with your attitude, Job. Job has, he doesn't have anything to argue with about that. That's actually true. There's no answer for this. And he has avoided the problems of the other three guys. And he's actually basically kind of told them off. They actually wouldn't disagree with anything Elihu has said. I think Elihu's a bright guy. And I think the Lord really did give him something to say. And it leads directly in to chapter 38, which we'll cover in a couple of weeks when we get back. And Job actually gets to talk to God. I mean, the Lord really does come and speak to him. And he doesn't say, "Oh, Job, I'm so sorry. I wasn't looking when this happened." But you can read ahead, and we'll get back in a couple of weeks. I want to close with some thoughts here. Three things that I think we learned from this. And now remember, we are learning to walk with God in a fallen world. We're learning to walk with God in a fragile environment where our lives can take what we would call a bad turn anytime. Okay? Let's understand that. How do you walk with God in a way, in a world like this? How do you keep on keeping on and keep on trusting Him? Well, I think that we find three things to think about. Pieces of wisdom. How they fit into your situation, you're just going to have to pray about, I think. But let me share them with you and explain them a little bit. We find them in the Elihu speeches, okay? And they're really kind of throughout the whole fabric of the book. Here's the first one. It takes more than age to produce wisdom. Well, that's pretty clear. And Elihu actually says that. You can be an old guy and you can still be a dumb guy. Okay? Now, the thing is that the older you get, the more life experience you have, and life experience is vital to have wisdom. A seven-year-old, well, we're reading about seven-year-olds, or was it a TV show? That seven-year-olds that go to college, you know, 15-year-olds that are teaching physics someplace, you know, people who are geniuses. The funny thing is they cannot possibly have wisdom. They can have a lot of knowledge, but they can't have wisdom because they don't have life experience. Life experience is what actually lays the groundwork for wisdom. However, and this is where Elihu comes in, life experience alone does not make a person mature or wise. If you don't take God's actual wisdom that He gives us and apply it in the stresses of life, the stresses of life, the problems and the hassles and the hurts and the pains of life, where the plow has gone into our life and dug it all up, that's where the seeds of wisdom are planted. It's not possible to be truly wise without some significant life experience. But it is possible to have significant life experience and not have real wisdom because of not listening to God through the years. And that's why a relatively young person who wants to listen to the Lord and wants to speak for God can often have much more actual wisdom to share than a person twice their age, sometimes three times their age. That's how that can happen. And Elihu actually demonstrates that pretty clearly. We want to grow in wisdom as we grow older. Our life experience grows, and there's a lot of things we know about life the older we get, and we can share it with folks that are younger than we are. Details and facts and ways to get along in life that you just have to learn the hard way. It's good to know them. But woe to us if we grow older without growing truly mature by allowing the Word of God to challenge our thinking when it hurts, when it really hurts. Woe to us if we don't allow the stresses of life to actually be the openings for the wisdom of God to come in so that we respond with the kind of character He wants us to. If we do let that happen, then the older we are, praise the Lord, the wiser we will be. But it takes more than age to produce wisdom. Number two, it takes more than blessing to produce discipleship. We say, oh Lord, bless me with discipleship. And we mean, let me have a nice, easy, straight, smooth path to spiritual maturity. But it takes more than, quote, blessings to produce real discipleship. It actually takes hurt. It actually takes trials and tribulations. And that's why James chapter 1, Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews 12 talks about discipline that hurts. James 1 just talks about the hassles and the hurts of life. And in both cases, they are seen very clearly as God's hand to bring ultimate long-term blessing. Now, Job worshiped God before these things occurred. And it says he was a godly man and he made sacrifices to the Lord. That means he lived by grace because he made sacrifices. That means he was trusting the grace of God and giving thanks to God and so on. All these things he was doing right. But I'll bet you anything, they weren't nearly as powerful as the ones he did after the thing was over. When it was all over, and he had hurt, and he had cried, and he had sworn, and he had pounded his fist against the ashes, and he'd hated his life, and he wanted to die, and then God came and rebuked him, and Job said, well, you'll read ahead, and you'll find out what Job said. You go ahead and read that. And then God restored his life, and then Job worshiped in a way that he could never have worshiped before. Because it takes more than blessing to produce discipleship. It takes hurt, honestly. In a fallen world, because we are redeemed sinners, the path to wisdom and joy is a path that involves some serious pain, some serious hurt. We see that in Job. Third, it takes more than justice to produce worship. And what I mean by that is, the difference between Elihu's approach to God, which was worshipful. Job, would you just think about how good God is for a minute? Would you just consider him? Would you just be absorbed with who God is? Words now, his other three friends were very interested in making sure that Job understood that God would always punish evil people and he would always bless what they thought were good people. And that is strict justice. Now listen. There is a place for that. God's word is clear on this. And as a matter of fact, in our culture, we've sort of forgotten it. And so we could use a dose of this. But there's more to true understanding of God than just understanding his worship. I mean, than just understanding his justice. There's more than just justice. There's the character of God. There's the glory of God. There's the majesty of God. There's the incredible brilliance of God. And this was something the other men did not focus on. They kept pounding away at Job's guilt, which wasn't there to pound away on. So they tried to create it. And what Elihu did was he said, I'm not going to argue with you about whether you think you've done anything wrong in the past. Obviously, you don't. But let me argue with you about this. Right now, A, you're not trusting God, Job, and you know it, and I know it. B, God is worth trusting. You know it, and I know it. What's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with the picture is a low view of God. And real worship doesn't come from just understanding God's justice. Real worship comes from understanding his character, his glory, and his holiness, and his majesty. Because he's awesome. He's utterly awesome, beyond our wildest imaginations. He will blow our minds for all of eternity. He has created all the stuff that it takes us generation upon generation to try and begin to think about figuring out. I listened to a physicist on the radio last night trying to explain where it all came from, developing a theory of everything. That's what they called it. We're developing a theory of everything. We've almost got it figured out. The guy said, really? Do we have it all figured out? Yeah, I think we do, but we won't figure it out in our lifetime. It'll have to happen in generations to come, but they'll eventually figure it all out, the theory of everything. And I thought about the mice and the strings, you know? The theory of everything. And, you know, interestingly, he said, it is about music. I don't know anything about physics, but he said, believe it or not, it is about math and it is about music. And there is music in 11 dimensions in the universe. I'm listening to this as I'm driving along. I'm thinking, if this guy knew what it says in the Bible or believed it, which he doesn't, he's an atheist. He's a philosophical naturalist and doesn't believe in God. But here he's talking about the glory of God who plays the music that makes life occur in the universe. Now you see, guys, that's where worship comes from. Understanding who God is. Job's friends kind of went at it the wrong way with Job. It takes more than age to produce wisdom. It takes more than blessing to produce discipleship in this world. And it takes more than justice to produce worship. Let's bow our heads, close our eyes. Father, we pray that you'd help us. These aren't three quick, easy answers to make things simple and pleasant in our life every day. They're actually kind of deep things to think about. And maybe they don't have an immediate, direct change upon the details of our lives, the lost jobs, the lost health, the lost spouses or kids or whatever that we're facing. And yet, Lord, in these things, we pray that you would raise our awareness of who you are, to lift our eyes above the difficulties which we admit we cannot understand and probably will never completely comprehend while we're here on earth. Father, lift our eyes above these things. And thank you for the words of Elihu in this series of speeches he gave that sort of did this for Job. And if we, Lord, are enamored of our suffering, really enamored of our own suffering, so overwhelmed that we can't see beyond it, Father, I pray, we pray, that you'd bring our thoughts to your glory. Because, Lord, we do love you so much. Truly and truly. In Jesus' name, amen.